He wasn't really trying to deceive people, he was just shoving pacifiers in their mouths. Any time that begin might slip and inadvertently tell the plain truth, the press and the US government were quick to interpret it as only a bargaining position. Nobody in this country wanted to think, or would let himself believe, that Begin, and later Shamir, meant exactly what he said back home one. There would never be a Palestinian homeland, much less a Palestinian state too. That Israel did not want autonomy for the Palestinians, it wanted to get rid of them by any means necessary. 3. That the Israeli settlements on the West Bank and Gaza would never stop, but would continue to be established as fast as the US supplied the money to build them. In other words, nothing had changed since the early Zionists said, after the Balfour Declaration, Palestine is going to be as Jewish as England is English. Since nobody in the US government had the courage to be the first to say the emperor has no clothes on, our Middle East policy lapsed into schizophrenia, a major factor in creating the dangerous deadlock underlying the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. For 13 years, the US has meekly participated in this charade. Our presidents and diplomats have developed a special vocabulary to be used in reporting on the results of meetings between representatives of Israel and the US, samples of post-meeting announcements by US officials with accompanying translations are, "The meeting was useful. We agreed on nothing. The meeting was frank. We disagreed on everything. The meeting was constructive. We are not sure what we agreed on." Huckabee says that the US has occasionally been known to muster up enough courage to describe Israeli defiance as unhelpful or an obstacle to peace. This diplomatic cowardice on the part of the US is not only responsible for Israel's perilous predicament, but it has cost the US dearly in the respect of its friends and allies. Never has the United Nations been more united, never has Israel been so alone as on the day the UN voted 150-2 to go to Geneva to hear Yasser Arafat. The frustrations and disappointments which the US has experienced over the past 13 years in trying to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict are the consequences of our failure to recognize two fundamental one. The Likud government of Israel is contemptuous of the US and has no respect either for the US government or the American people too. The leaders of the Likud government do not want, and never have wanted, peace, they dread it. Their only interest is power, and the evidence which supports these conclusions is extensive, and is set. The contempt which the Likud has for the US is obvious, and it is richly deserved. They know better than anybody that Israel can make or break US presidents, senators, congressmen, and diplomats. How could the Likud leadership be expected to feel otherwise than contemptuous, when every representative of the US government wears a collar around his neck and they know the leash is held by their friends and colleagues in the Israeli? The most recent examples of the humiliating condescension with which the Likud leadership treats the US are found in two articles in the Jerusalem Post by Abay Eban having to do with Secretary of State George Shultz's visit to Israel in the latter part of 1988 to discuss a peace initiative. In the first article entitled, "The Threats Are From Within," Eban, "Nothing in our region is too improbable to be true." Israeli leaders, the Israeli press, American Jewish supporters of Israel, and some celebrated columnists are justly castigating the Palestinian leadership for not being sufficiently emphatic in supporting Resolution 242. All of them have overlooked the awkward fact that the Israeli government does not support it at all. "We are recommending strong medicine for others, while Mr. Shami has never allowed any mention of 242 to pass his lips, except in tones of rejection. Compared with Mr. Shami, the Palestine National Council is almost a devotee of 242. Resolutions 242 and 338 are at least mentioned in the PNC statement. There is no trace of them whatever in the Israeli coalition agreement, because the Likud negotiators in 1984 resisted the Labour proposal to include 242 as one of the sources of Israeli governmental policy. During Secretary of State Shultz's visit to this area last September, Mr. Shami told him that 242 is not applicable to a negotiation with the Jordanians and Palestinians, because the resolution was exhausted by the withdrawal from Sinai, which also would never have taken place if Mr. Shami had been prime minister in 1977. This prime ministerial rejection of 242 led to the collapse of the Schultz initiative, and contributed to the disengagement of King Hussein from the peace process. While some governments have not explicitly endorsed 242, Mr. Shamir is the only prime minister in the world who has actually turned it down, emphasis supplied. In a follow-up article in the Jerusalem Post, Eben blames Shami for destroying the American peace proposals. Jordan's role became additionally impossible when Mr. Shami told Secretary Schultz that he stood both for resolution 242 and for permanent Israel retention of all of the territory under Israel's control. It is intellectually respectable to be for one of these, but to invoke both is sheer frivolity. Moreover, in the Camp David framework agreement, the Israel government, then under Likud control, declared that the future status of the West Bank and Gaza and Israel's negotiation of a peace treaty with Jordan must be governed by all the principles and provisions of 242, one of which is withdrawal of forces. To be for Camp David, and also for total Israeli control of the entire West Bank and Gaza is thus just as absurd as to be for 242 and to be in favor of West Bank settlements. To interpret a legal document against its legislative history, and against the intention of all of its sponsors mocks intellectual integrity, and is a bizarre doctrine, emphasis supplied. Perhaps the only surprise in this is that Eben was surprised. The US experience proved long ago that dealing in absurdity, frivolity and mocking intellectual integrity is what the Likud does best. Shamir is merely indulging in a little Bijin speak in which he has become very fluent. The second reality: the record of the past 13 years demonstrates that no one has worked harder than Menachem Begin to save Israel from peace. As Huckabee states, Begin's primary motivation in starting the disastrous war in Lebanon was fear of the momentum of the peace movement, and that he might be called upon to honor his signature on the Camp David Accords. As previously noted, Huckabee called the Lebanon War the war to safeguard the occupation of the West Bank. Ariel Sharon, hero of the battles of the refugee camps, was the other instigator of the Lebanon War, which was based on lies and deceit at the highest level. Sharon saw himself, Amos Perlmutter says, as the king of Israel. While all the nations of the world understand and recognize the hypocrisy of the Likud's peace process, the Likud continues to make a mockery out of US peace efforts and a game out of fooling Washington. There is no question that Shamir also knows how to handle the Americans. In an article in the Jerusalem Post of March 6, 1989, entitled "The Illusion of Shamir's Peace Plan," Israeli journalist Uri Avery writes, "The new Israeli peace ideas, revealed last month by Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, bring to mind the stage routine in which the illusion of walking, and even sprinting, is created without the pantomimist advancing a single inch." Shamir's intention was to generate feverish diplomatic activity, giving the illusion of movement without actually advancing even an inch closer to peace. In the July 17, 1989, issue of Time magazine, an article was published entitled "Power, Not Peace." A portion of the article is quoted below. "Extremism was in the ascendancy again last week in the Middle East. Capitulating to the hardline right of his Likud bloc, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir fettered his own plan for elections in the occupied territories with stiff conditions that seemed to doom the peace initiative. Shamir's initiative was never more than a tentative move toward starting a dialogue between the Israelis and the Palestinians. It offered Arabs in the occupied territories the chance to elect representatives, to negotiate with Israel a transitional period of self-rule, a possible beginning, if Palestinians were willing to take it. But under the terms of the initiative, the Palestinian representatives could have no overt connection with the Palestine Liberation Organization. Not surprisingly, no Palestinians rushed to embrace the scheme. Still, coaxed by the US, the PLO was giving the plan serious consideration. Last week those hopes lay in rubble. Rather than risk losing power,